precious hours of darkness between awakening and having to get up, the only hours when I could luxuriate in being alone. I had not forgotten the body in the chimney. It was simply that there had been no time to think about its blackened bones and clutching fingers, at least until now. Somewhere in the recesses of my brain, a memory was shaken loose and fell with a clunk into my consciousness. The metal medallion! I had taken it from the corpse's hand and shoved it into my pocket. I let my legs fall and flipped out of bed onto the floor. I reached carefully into the right jacket pocket of my school uniform, which I had left hanging, against the rules, on the back of a chair. Thank heavens Miss Fawthorne was not here to see it. The pocket was empty. I checked the other. Nothing. But wait. When the body had come tumbling out of the chimney, I was wearing the outfit in which I arrived in Canada. Skirt, blouse, and jumper. It was hanging in the cupboard. I held my breath as I dipped my hand into the folds of my former clothing. Thank heavens! In an instant, the little object was resting tightly in the palm of my hand. Almost without thinking, I switched on the forbidden light. When I realized what I had done, I listened intently, putting my near supernatural hearing to the utmost test. But the house was quiet as a country crypt. Not a creature was stirring, and so forth, except me. In my hand was an object no bigger than the first joint of my thumb. A magnifying lens would have been a godsend, but alas, alas, I was lensless. Perhaps I could improvise with a pinhole punched in a piece of paper. But wait, I'd almost forgotten. Hadn't Aunt Felicity given me that utility crucifix, a veritable Swiss Army knife of prayer, the very tool I needed, and it was hanging round my neck? As I reached for it, I offered up a prayer of thanks to Saint Jerome, the patron saint of spectacles. I flicked out the pivoted glass and examined the object I was now holding gingerly between thumb and forefinger. I knew at once from its tarnished surface that it would require special handling. It would have to wait until I was alone in the chemistry lab and able to analyze it at my leisure. The thing had a face, though, that much I could tell. And wings. Yes, it looked very much like a wrapped body. It brought to mind the famous statue we had seen at St. Paul's of John Donne, its one-time dean, who was believed to have posed for it in his shroud on his deathbed. It was also said to be the only one of the cathedral statues that had survived the Great Fire of 1666. Even now, after nearly 300 years, some of the soot smudges were still visible. And like poor Donne's effigy, this little winged figure had been subjected to heat. Coincidence? I surely hoped not. I was so intent upon peering through the magnifying glass that I did not hear the door open. I had forgotten to lock the blasted thing. I did not know Miss Fawthorne was there until she spoke.
What is the meaning of this?
She said it in the same slow, cold, slippery, sinister tones that the snake must have used when speaking to Eve in the Garden of Eden. With lightning reflexes, I slid the medallion into the pocket of my dressing gown and wrapped it in the depths of my handkerchief.
What have you got there?
Nothing, Miss Fawthorne.
Nonsense! What is it? Hand it over!
It was an all-or-nothing moment, the moment of truth, as bullfighters call it, or, in my case, the moment of untruth. Please, miss, phlegm, I said, pulling the handkerchief from my pocket and holding it out for her inspection. I arranged my features into a look of embarrassment. I think I've caught rather a bad chill. As added insurance, I brought up from the very depths of my gizzard a convincing cough, and spat an imaginary substance into the crumpled handkerchief. Again, I offered it. It requires a certain nerve to play at this kind of game, a kind of steely bluff combined with the innocence of a baby lily, and I must say that I was rather good at it.
Put that filthy thing away, Miss Fawthorne said with a look of disgust, before abruptly changing the subject. Why are these lights turned on?
I almost said, I thought I was coughing up blood and wanted to have a look. But something told me to quit while I was ahead.
I got up early to write my report on William Palmer, I said, giving my mouth a final wipe and gesturing to my notebook and pen, which were, praise be, lying on my desktop.
What a perfect title that would make for one of the volumes of my autobiography when it comes time to write it. Lying on my desktop. I must remember to make a note of it.
Miss Fawthorne said nothing, but stared at me steadily, the ruby pin at her throat rising and falling in slow, regular, hypnotic waves, one breath after another. I cannot allow this to pass, Flavia, she said at last, as if she had come to a sudden decision. Do you understand?
I nodded, suddenly Miss Humility herself.
We shall have a talk, she said, but not here, and not now. Immediately after your gymnasium class this morning, I want you to go out for a long walk, alone, and reflect upon your disobedience. When you have done so to my satisfaction, well, we shall see. The gymnasium was an echoing canyon with a floor on several levels. It had once been a chapel with towering stone arches, sunken aisles, gilded organ pipes, and quaint grottos. But now the saints and martyrs in the stained glass windows had nothing better to look down upon than a clutter of vaulting horses, parallel bars, climbing ropes, and rings suspended on chains, remarkably like the torture chamber in a castle I had once toured in Girl Guides. I felt even more cold and naked and doltish in the square-necked navy gym slip than I had the first time, as if I were the village idiot in a smock, or a cowering pawn on someone else's chessboard. A shrill whistle blew as I entered, and instructions were shouted.
Left arm upward, right arm forward. Stretch, right arm forward, left arm upward. Stretch, head forward, bend, stretch, head left sideways, bend, stretch.
I must be honest about the fact that I'm made extremely uneasy by excessive noise and that I do not care for shouted instructions. If I'd been meant to be a sheep, I reasoned, I'd have been born with wool instead of skin. I swarmed up a wooden ladder, dropped heavily to the mat, gave out a little cry of agony, winced in the direction of Miss Puddycomb, the game's mistress, hooked my leg at an awkward angle, as if to check for a broken bone, massaged my calf, and limped off to my room to get rid of the clown outfit. We'd deal with the paperwork later. I was blessed to have been born with an excellent sense of direction, so that even in the bath, or the WC, I always have a fairly good idea of which way's north. Standing in the street outside Miss Bodycote's, I could have gone either north or south, but decided to strike off north because it was my favourite direction. North lay the North Pole, which seemed so much closer here in Canada than it had at Buckshaw. Too far north, I knew, and you ran out of trees and into polar bears. But there seemed little chance of that with streetcars, clanging away at the end of the block. But I soon reconsidered. I was supposed to be thinking about my disobedience. But instead I found myself realizing that in street upon changing street of nearly identical houses, I might well become lost. I was, after all, in a strange city. Face it, Flavia, in a strange country. Who knew what unsuspected dangers lurked just round the next corner? A woman in a pink knitted hat came running out of a house whose windows upstairs were covered with bedsheets and an unfamiliar flag.
"Are you lost?" she called out, after no more than a glance at me.
Could it be so obvious that I was a stranger? I smiled at her. No point in aggravating the natives. Turned on my heel and went back the way I had come. It didn't take much thinking to realize that there was much greater safety in sticking to the busier streets.
"Follow the tram lines," my instinct was whispering into my ear.
A few minutes later, I found myself once more in front of Miss Bodycote's, from which a buzz of busy voices floated to my ears. It was good to be outdoors. It was good to be alone. I marched off to the south until I saw a Danforth Avenue street sign, at which point I turned my face toward the west. It is a remarkable fact, and one not often commented upon, how hard it is to walk upon pavement after a lifetime of village streets and country lanes. Before I had gone a mile, I made a pretext of stopping at what appeared to be a greengrocer's shop for a bottle of ginger beer.
"Your money's no good here, dear," the elderly woman behind the counter said, after examining and handing me back my shilling.
"Tell you what, I'll give you a bottle of cold pop just for the pleasure of hearing you talk. You have such a lovely accent. Go ahead, say something."
I did not like thinking of myself as having an accent. It was everyone else who had one. "Thank you," I said, but I knew, even as I spoke, that "thank you" was not enough to pay for a drink.
"No, something decent," she said. "Give us a song, or some poetry."
Other than a couple of comic verses about chemistry, which didn't seem appropriate to the occasion, the only poem that I could remember was one I had heard a couple of little girls chanting as they skipped rope in Cow Lane, back home in Bishop's Lacey, which seemed now like a remembered scene from a previous life. I launched into it before shame could make me change my mind and bolt. Striking a demure pose with my hands clasped at my waist, I began.
"Poor little Leo was sunk by a torpedo. They brought him back in a Union Jack from over the bounding sea, yo. Poor little Leo, he lost his life in Rio. They brought him back in a Union Jack from over the bounding sea, yo."
"That's lovely, dear," the woman said, reaching into a cooling cabinet and handing over a frosty bottle of Orange Crush. "I had a nephew, Leo, once. He wasn't sunk by a torpedo, but he did move to Florida. What do you think about that?"
I smiled, because it seemed the proper thing to do. I was already on the street, strolling quickly away, when the words of the stupid rhyme came flooding back into my head. "They brought him back in a Union Jack." Why did they seem so familiar? It took a moment for the penny to drop.
"Brought him back in a Union Jack, just like the body that had fallen out of the chimney."
Could there possibly be a connection? Was someone, some unknown killer, murdering his victims, according to the skipping rhymes of school children, in the way that Miss Christie has written about?
Daffy had told me about the mysteries based upon nursery rhymes, railway guides and so forth. But was it even remotely possible that a Canadian killer had decided to copy those methods? The very thought of it both excited and chilled me. On the one hand, I might well have part of the solution already in hand. But on the other, the killer could still be at large, and not far away. I'm afraid I wasn't getting far with reflecting upon my disobedience. Miss Fawthorne would almost certainly quiz me when I got back to the academy, and I'd need to have some kind of acceptable penitence prepared.
But a body in the chimney isn't something that falls into your lap every day, and I needed now to give it my undivided attention.
All the nitpicking at Miss Bodycote's had been so distracting that the flag-wrapped corpse had been forced to climb into the back seat, as it were. By now, I was crossing a tall limestone bridge or viaduct which crossed a broad valley. I hauled myself up by the elbows on the rail and peered over the side at the muddy brown water that seeped sluggishly along far below. It was a long way down, and the very thought of it made my stomach feel ticklish. I walked on, unwilling or unable to turn round and go back to captivity.
Captivity. Yes, that was it. I was the tiger, caged in a zoo, longing to be returned home to its jungle.
Perhaps I could escape, as tigers were occasionally reported to do in the newspapers. In fact, I was already out, wasn't I?
Chapter 12.
Perhaps I should make a break for it. I could be well on my way to England before they even realized I was missing. But other than the few useless coins in my pocket, I had no money. Perhaps I could ask a stranger for directions to the police station and throw myself, as a refugee, upon the mercy of Inspector Gravenhurst. Or would he be obliged by law to take me into custody? The police station, however fascinating it might be, would be far less comfortable than Miss Bodycote's, what with the drunken prisoners in the clink, the noise, the swearing, and so forth. I still needed to find a quiet place to sit down and think this through. I had now reached the far side of the viaduct and was walking along a broad and busy city street. And just like that, as if by some heaven-sent miracle, a churchyard appeared, as if out of nowhere, and I made for it at once. It was not quite as good as being whisked back to Bishop's Lacey, but for now it would do. No sooner was I safely among the gravestones than a great feeling of warmth and calm contentment came sweeping over me. Life among the dead. This was where I was meant to be. What a revelation! And what a place to have it! I could succeed at whatever I chose. I could, for instance, become an undertaker, or a pathologist, a detective, a gravedigger, a tombstone maker, or even the world's greatest murderer. Suddenly, the world was my oyster, even if it was a dead one. I threw my hands up into the air and launched myself into a series of exuberant triple cartwheels. Yaroo! I shouted. When I landed on my feet, I found myself face to face with Miss Fawthorne.
Most impressive, she said, but not ladylike, particularly.
Joy turned to terror. My heart felt squeezed in an iron fist. I needed to get the upper hand, even if only for a few moments, before this woman killed me and shoveled me into a shallow grave. Who would ever think to look in a cemetery for a missing girl? She had planned this to perfection. But how could she be sure that I would come to this place?
You followed me, I said.
Of course I did, she smiled.
But I didn't see you.
Of course you didn't. That is because you failed to look in the right place. My face must have been as blank as the side of a barn. Most people who suspect they are being followed look behind themselves. Consequently, the superior tracker is always ahead of her quarry. Now then, have you done as you were instructed? Have you reflected upon your insubordination?
No, I said. So you might as well go ahead and kill me.
And I might as well die defiant, I thought.
Kill you, she said, throwing back her head, laughing with delight, and showing, for the first time, a complete set of small but perfect teeth. Why on earth should I want to kill you? I shrugged. It was always better to let the killer do all the talking. In that way, you were able to gain much more information than you gave up. Let me tell you something, Flavia. You're right about one thing. I might have killed you just then. At least, I might have wanted to. But only if you had answered yes. Only if you tried to convince me that you had reflected upon your disobedience. Only if you had spouted off some meaningless twaddle about how sorry you were. Only if you had promised improvement. But you did not. You stood firm. You proved that you are indeed the person I believed you to be. You are indeed your mother's daughter. It was more words than I had heard her say since we met. It was, in a way, as if the Sphinx had spoken. A crow gave a rude caw as it landed in one of the trees and regarded us in its hunchbacked way from the branch. How did we appear to a bird, I wondered. Two small, insignificant figures standing in a field of stones, I expect, and nothing more. I picked up a pebble and tossed it. The bird turned its back. Are you not at all curious about my reason for following you? Miss Fawthorne asked. I shrugged again, but then thought better of it, and said, Yes. It is a simple one, she said. It is because I wanted to be alone with you. Again, a small flame of fear flickered up in my mind. But not for any reason you may think. The truth is that today, here and now, in this churchyard, your real training begins in earnest. You must speak of it to no one. You will appear to be, for all intents and purposes, just another schoolgirl, and a rather dull one at that. She paused to let her words sink in, fixing me with the same bright eye as the crow had done. Come over here, she said, strolling across the graveyard and beckoning me to follow. She pointed to a rather plain and unremarkable tombstone. Cornelia Corwin, 1907 to 1944, she read aloud. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. You'd think she was some wealthy family's chambermaid, wouldn't you? Or perhaps a nanny. But she wasn't. She was one of us. Without Cornelia Corwin, there would have been no successful evacuation of Dunkirk. 300,000 men would have perished in vain. She bent over and gently brushed away a dead leaf that had settled on the tombstone. Do you understand what I'm saying? Yes, I said, looking her straight in the eye. Excellent, she said. We must understand each other perfectly. There must be no barrier to communications between us. Now then. As she spoke, she began to stroll among the tombstones, and I fell into lockstep beside her. Miss Bodycote's Female Academy is a house divided, not by descent, but by choice. The day girls know nothing of what goes on with the boarders, such as yourself. The day girls are a friend, you mean? I said. Flavia, you simply amaze me. I glanced up at her proudly. You will be taught everything you need to know, but you will be taught it discreetly. You will be trained in the arts of genteel mayhem. Oh, don't look at me like that. The vegetable scraper, the cheese grater, and the corkscrew are often overlooked as effective means of disposing of an adversary. You know, even the pickle fork in a pinch. Was she teasing me? But the war has been over for ages, I said. Precisely so. You will discover that certain skills become even more essential in peacetime. She saw at once the look of horror on my face. At Miss Bodycote's, she went on, we encourage our girls in all aspects. But, I said, in all aspects. Do you understand, Flavia? What about poisons? I asked, hoping against hope. Of course you'll be taught the more traditional skills, she continued, ignoring my question. such as ciphers and code-breaking, and so forth, as well as the more modern and inventive arts that are not yet dreamed of by even the most sensational of our novelists. "My Aunt Felicity told me I was to become a member of the NIDE," I began. The NIDE was the name of the hush-hush organization into which I was to be inducted, my reason for being in Canada.
"Shh," she said, reaching out and touching my lips. "You must never utter that word again. Never."
"But how will I know which of the borders?"
She touched a gentle finger to my lips. "They will make themselves known to you. Until they do, trust no one."
"What about Jumbo? What about Van Ark?"
"All in due time, Flavia."
How easy, I supposed, it would have been at that moment to ask Miss Fawthorne if she had heard anything about the identity of the corpse that had plummeted out of the chimney. And yet it was not. A conversation between a person of my age and a person of hers is like a map of a maze. There are things that each of us knows, and that each of us knows the other knows, that can be talked about. But there are things that each of us knows that the other doesn't know we know, which must not be spoken of, no matter what. Because of our ages, and for reasons of decency, there are what Daffy would refer to as taboos, forbidden topics which we may stroll among like islands of horse dung in the road, that although perfectly evident to both of us, must not be mentioned or kicked at any cost. It's a strange world when you come right down to it.
"You must learn not to ask unnecessary questions," Miss Fawthorne went on, as if she were reading my mind. "It is a cardinal rule here that no girl may give out any information whatsoever about any other girl, past or present."
Her words had an eerily familiar ring.
"Certain questions must not be asked," Aunt Felicity had told me, as we walked together on the visto at Buckshaw.
Now, here it was again.
"You mean I need to deduce those facts myself," I declared flatly, taking care to make it a statement rather than a direct query.
"Gold Star," she said quietly, almost as if to herself, as she looked off, almost idly, into the distance. A gentle wind stirred the leaves, and in it was a touch of coldness. It was, after all, autumn.
"There will be field trips," Miss Fawthorne went on suddenly, "which will require a great deal of courage on your part. I trust that you will not let us down."
"Did Harriet undergo this training?" I asked.
Her silence was an answer in itself.
"I have arranged with Mrs. Bannerman to tutor you in advanced chemistry. She assures me that your level of comprehension is far beyond expectations. You will begin work with both the electron microscope and the hydrogen spectrophotometer almost at once."
Yahoo!
I couldn't believe my ears. This truly was heaven with knobs on. And I don't mind telling you that it is entirely due to the influence, in high places, of the elder Miss Toulouse, that our humble establishment has been presented with the funds necessary to acquire such advanced apparatuses.
The elder Miss Toulouse?
Aunt Felicity, of course. Aunt Felicity had not taken credit for herself when she mentioned the latest scientific equipment with which Miss Bodycoats had been endowed. But now everything was suddenly, remarkably, brilliantly clear. Miss Fawthorne smiled as if she were reading my mind.
"So you see," she said, "in a way, if there had been no Flavia Deluce, there also may not have been, for much longer, a Miss Bodycote's Female Academy." I'm afraid I could do no more than gape as the meaning of her words took root. "We have a great deal riding upon you, Flavia. A very great deal."
What could I do? What could I say? The whole world had suddenly, and without warning, revealed itself to be far larger a place than ever I could have dreamed of. I was standing at the edge of a very great abyss, whose further lip was so far beyond imagination that only faith could bridge the gap. It was, I suppose, the bridge connecting childhood with whatever vast unknown might lie beyond. I know now that there is a very precise instant when one stands at that threshold at which the choice must be made, whether to remain, even if only for a while, a child, or whether to step boldly across into another world. I did the only thing I could think of. I seized Miss Fawthorne's hand and gave it a jolly good shake.
Excellent, she said. I'm glad that we understand each other. Now then.
Was I imagining it? Or was she now speaking to me in an entirely different tone? An entirely different voice?
Your work with Mrs. Bannerman must, necessarily, take place in the small hours. You must not be seen to be spending an unusual amount of time in her company, although you may, of course, at your own discretion, occasionally feign stupidity as an excuse to return to her classroom for explanation or clarification after your regular chemistry class.
Feigning stupidity was one of my specialties. If stupidity were theoretical physics, then I would be Albert Einstein.
But for now, Miss Fawthorne went on, making a broad sweep of her arm, which took in all of our immediate surroundings, this will be your classroom. No one pays the slightest bit of attention to a woman and a girl in a graveyard. What else can they be but mourners? What else can they be doing but grieving?
We walked for a long time among the tombstones, Miss Fawthorne and I, stopping occasionally to sit on a bench in the sunshine, or to rearrange the flowers on a random grave. At last, she looked at her wristwatch.
We'd better be getting back, she said. We shall split up and take different routes when we're 4 blocks from home.
Home. What a strange feeling word. It had been a long time since I had had one. Home. I repeated the word in my mind. It was good. And so we set off on the long walk home.
Much of what we talked about, I am forbidden to commit to paper.
Chapter 13. The alarm went off with a muted clatter. I reached under my pillow and silenced the thing, then hauled it out and looked blearily at the time. It was 3 a.m. Miss Fawthorne had planted the clock in my bed while I was in class, just as she had promised she would. The thing was a large, self-important alarm clock with radium hands that glowed greenly in the dark, and a bell loud enough to be heard through the feathers of the pillow, but not outside my room. I stretched, climbed out onto the cold floor, and hurriedly dressed, taking great care to be mouse quiet. There had been several good reasons to assign me to Edith Cavell, Miss Fawthorne had explained, not the least of which was to make possible my starlight studies, as she jokingly called them. She had asked Mr. Tugg to oil the hinges so that I was able to come and go in perfect silence. Some of the girls had grumbled, of course, about a scabby fourth former having her own room. But the story had been put about that for certain reasons I was not a fit roommate. Flatulence, I believe, although I can't prove it. For a time I was the butt of their jokes, but after a while they tired of it and moved on to fresher cruelties and easier victims. Mrs. Bannerman was awaiting me in the chemistry lab. She had already drawn the heavy blackout curtains that had been installed to allow demonstration of certain experiments with light. But I must say no more. And to permit the showing of instructional cine films in perfect darkness. For 3 o'clock in the morning, Mrs. Bannerman looked remarkably fresh. Perhaps vivacious is more the word. Her hair was perfection, as if she had just stepped out of the salon, and she smelled of lilies of the valley. She reminded me a great deal of the young chorus girl, Audrey Hepburn, whom Aunt Felicity had pointed out when she took us as a rare treat to a West End theatre.
"I knew her in an earlier life," my aunt had whispered.
"I didn't know you believed in reincarnation, Auntie Fee," Feely had said.
"I don't," she had replied. "Shh."
"Good morning, Flavia," Mrs. Bannerman said brightly. "Welcome to my little kitchen. Would you like a cup of tea?"
"Yes, please," I said, somewhat flustered.
The only other person who had ever invited me to tea was Antigone Hewitt, the inspector's wife, who was now, perhaps, through my own fault, lost to me forever. She had not even turned up to bid me farewell, as I had so desperately hoped she would. Perhaps she hadn't known that I was leaving. Had her husband not told her? But he himself might not have known that I was being banished. I might die an old woman without ever learning the truth. All this was going through my mind as the tea steeped in the lengthening silence.
"You're looking very thoughtful," Mrs. Bannerman said.
"Yes," I told her. "I was just thinking of home."
"I do sometimes, too," she said. "It's not always as pleasant as one expects, is it? Now then, shall we get started?"
I was a bit shy of the electron microscope at first, reluctant even to touch it. But when Mrs. Bannerman brought up on the cathode ray screen the hairs of a louse magnified nearly 60,000 times, my reverent fingers were everywhere, caressing the thing as if it were a favorite pet. Wild horses couldn't have dragged me away.
The first electron microscope in North America was built by a couple of students not far from here, at the University of Toronto, she told me, before you were born. What we are now observing is the leg of a species of louse called Columbicula extinctus, or passenger pigeon-chewing louse, which lived exclusively upon the body of that particular bird, which has been extinct since 1914. Why it should have been found a month ago in the hair of a murdered clergyman in the Klondike makes for a pretty little puzzle.
Ah, I see that I now have your undivided attention.
Murdered? I asked. What a peculiar feeling it was to be sitting in a locked room in the middle of the night, sharing a microscope with a woman who had herself been tried for murder. I wouldn't have thought the subject would come up so easily.
Yes, murdered, she said. I provide assistance to the police from time to time as a way of keeping my hand in. Although I earn my bread and butter by teaching chemistry, my professional qualifications are actually as an entomologist.
I hadn't the foggiest idea what an entomologist was, but I could already feel the look of admiration spreading across my face.
Bugs, she said, including insects, spiders, centipedes, worms. I specialize in the ways in which their study may be used in criminal investigation. It's quite a new field, but also a very old one. Shouldn't you be making notes?
I had been too entranced to do anything but gape.
Here's a notebook, she said, handing me a red-covered secretary's dictation pad. When it's full, ask for another. You may write as much as you wish, but with one proviso. Your notebooks are never to leave this room. They will be kept here under lock and key, but you may add to them or consult them at any time.
She didn't say, "Do you understand?" and I blessed her for that.
Now then, at the top of your first page, write this name, Jean-Pierre Mignon.
She spelled it out for me and made sure I got the accent leaning in the right direction.
His two greatest works are Le Fond des Tombeaux and Le Fond des Cadavres. Roughly translated, that means Creatures of the Tomb and the Wildlife of Corpses. Sounds a bit like a double bill horror movie, doesn't it? Both are in French. Do you have any inkling of the language?
No, I said, shaking my head sadly.
What had I been missing? How could such treasures exist in a language I was unable to read? Perhaps Miss Dupont could give me extra tutoring in French, I blurted. I could hardly believe that I was listening to my own mouth speaking.
Excellent suggestion. I'm sure she would be, how do you say, enchantée?
Now then, pencil ready. Mignon discovered that those creatures which feed and breed upon corpses tend to arrive in waves. In the first stage, when the body is fresh, the blowflies appear. In the second stage, the body bloats as it putrefies, and certain beetles are attracted. As full-blown decay sets in at stage 3 and fermentation takes place, butyric and caseic acids are produced, followed by ammoniacal fermentation, at which point entirely different tribes of flies and beetles are attracted. Maggots proliferate. And so, as you will have deduced, it is possible, by studying the presence and life cycles of these various flying and crawling things, to work out with some precision how long the dearly departed has been dead, and even, perhaps, where they have been in the meantime.
Corruption? Putrefaction? Acids? This woman was speaking my language. I may not know French, but I knew the language of the dead, and this conversation was one I had been dreaming of all my life. I had found a kindred spirit. My brain was all aswirl, like one of those spiral galaxies you see in the illustrated news magazines. Sparks, flame, and fire fizzing and flying off in all directions, like a dizzying Catherine wheel on Guy Fawkes night. I couldn't sit still. I had to get up from my chair and pace round and up and down the room like a madwoman, simply to keep from exploding.
Heady stuff, isn't it?
Mrs. Bannerman asked. She understood perfectly the tears in my eyes.
I think we'll call it quits for tonight, she said, with an elaborate stretch and a yawn to match. I'm tired. I hope you'll forgive me. We've made an excellent start, but you need your sleep.
How I was dying to quiz her about Brasenose, Wentworth, and Le Marchand.
But something was holding me back. Miss Fawthorn had forbidden me to ask any of the girls about another.
But did the same restriction apply to the teaching staff?
As both Mrs. Mullet and Sir Humphrey Davy have said, better safe than sorry. And as for the little metal figure in my pocket, it would have to wait. I could hardly haul it out and begin heating it without a full confession of how I had come to have it in my possession. Besides entomology, I was going to have to learn patience. Back in my room, wrapped up in a blanket, I could not sleep. My head was filled with coffin flies, blowflies, maggots, and cheese skippers. The maggots were nothing new. I had thought of them often while dwelling on the delights of decomposition. Daffy had even read out to me at the breakfast table, "Knowing your proclivities," she had said, smirking, that wonderful passage from Love's Labour's Lost, where one of the characters says, "These summer flies have blown me full of maggot ostentation." It had caused Father to put aside his sausages, get up, and leave the room, but had given me a whole new appreciation of Shakespeare. Anyone who could write a line like that can't be too much of a stick in the mud. Dear Father, what a sad life he'd had. What a rotten hand fate had dealt him. A prisoner of war camp, the death of a young wife, a decaying pile for a house, 3 daughters, and no money to speak of. With Buckshaw now mine, in theory at least, some of the entanglement in which we had lived for as long as I could remember should have begun to be sorted out. But Harriet's will had raised at least as many questions as it had answered, and Father had been swept into the storm of legalities like a housefly into a tornado. There had been some hope that a grateful government would intervene, and I had learned, thanks to my acute hearing, that Father had spoken at length with Mr. Churchill on the telephone, and for a day or two his face had seemed a little less ashen, but nothing seemed to have come of it.
"It's exactly like Bleak House," Daffy had said, on another day when Father had left the table without finishing his breakfast. "They'll still be jawing about the excise tax long after we all are in our graves with spiders nesting in our skulls."
And then, of course, had come the day of my banishment, the day upon which I had truly become an exile, with England and Buckshaw now more than 3,000 miles somewhere across the sea. I had no way of knowing my family's fortunes. I was alone in the wilderness. And with that thought, I fell asleep. Someone was chopping trees in the forest. A woodcutter, perhaps. If only I could summon the strength to scream. But would he hear me? The noise of his axe was surely louder in his ears than any feeble cry that I might make. To make matters worse, a squadron of ships offshore had begun firing their cannon at some invisible enemy.
Boom! Boom! Boom!
I shoved my hands under the pillow to cover my head and banged my knuckles on a hard metal object. I hauled it out and held it up to my face. It was the alarm clock, and its hands were pointing to 8:20. I had slept right through its ringing.
"Flavia, open up!"
I toad-hopped from the bed to the door, unlocked it, and stuck my head out. There stood Van Ark, staring at me as if I were an apparition.
"Better get a move on," she said. "The Black Maria will be here in 10 minutes.
"Black Maria? What on earth is she talking about?"
"Oh, and incidentally," she added, "you ought to know that you look like the wreck of the Hesperus."
I flew about the room, scrubbing the taste of dead horses out of my mouth with toothpaste on my finger, raking the sticky grunge out of my eyes, giving my hair a lick and a promise with the hairbrush I had purloined from Harriet's boudoir. At last I was ready. 3 minutes down and 7 to go. The bed had to be made upon pain of punishment, and what a mess it was, as if some madwoman in Bedlam had spent the night in it, tossing in a straitjacket. Another 3 minutes. As I stepped into the hall, the building fell suddenly silent, in the way the birds do in a wood that a hunter has entered. I clattered down the stairs, making enough noise to raise the dead. Miss Fawthorne stood at the door, and as I approached, she swiveled and pointed with a long, forbidding finger to the outdoors, as if she were the ticket-taker for the ferry-boat on the River Styx.
"As if she had never seen me before!"
An ominous vehicle stood in the driveway. I thought at first it was a hearse, but quickly realized that the thing was far too large. It was a bus, a matte black bus with smoked windows and the heavy door standing open. It didn't have "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," painted above the door, but it might as well have. I put my foot onto the bottommost of the two steps, but because of the heavily tinted windows, and the fact that I was blinded by sunlight, I could make out no details of the gloomy interior.
"Hurry up, Toulouse,"
someone growled from out of the shadows. I climbed up, the doors hissed at my heels, and we jerked into motion. I tottered to a seat, going mostly by the sense of feel. The driver shifted through a seemingly endless number of gears, until at last he settled upon one that displeased him the least. By the position of the sun through the windscreen, I judged that we were now travelling east. As my eyes accustomed themselves to the gloom, I looked round at some of my fellow passengers. Van Ark sat opposite, 2 rows back, her nose pressed against the window. Behind Van Ark, Jumbo was examining her nails as intently as if they were lost scripture. And at the back of the bus, in the middle of the aisle, was Miss Moat, the science mistress, the woman who had accosted me in the hall. Her wheelchair was lashed to the seats on either side by a network of belts, so that she seemed to hang suspended like a spider lurking at the centre of its web. I looked away quickly, flexing my neck in a complex set of side-to-side stretches, as if I were merely working out a morning kink. Aside from the labouring engine, which sounded to be making much ado about nothing, a characteristic shared, I have come to believe, by all buses everywhere, we rattled along quite briskly. We had soon broken free of the suburbs and were making our way along a two-lane macadamised motorway, which snaked easily between green fields dotted with cows and hay bales. If the truth be told, it wasn't all that much different from England. Electrical wires and telephone lines on both sides rose and fell, in long scallops, like the flight path of a determined woodpecker. How far had we come? I tried to work it out in my head. The roadside speed limit signs allowed a maximum of 50 miles per hour, and a minimum of 30 in the settled areas, an average, say, of 40 miles per hour. Now then, how long had we been travelling? I thought back to my girl guide's training in the parish hall when Miss Delaney had taught us to estimate time in stressful situations.
"One never knows when one may be kidnapped by communists," she told us. "Or worse," she added. "Be prepared is more than just a motto."
And so we had been made to learn how to estimate time while locked away alone in total darkness in the crypt of St. Tancred's, as well as while balancing blindfolded on a chair as a gang of girls, singing at the top of their lungs,
"Ging-gang, gooly-gooly-gooly-gooly, watcha, ging-gang-goo, ging-gang-goo," held tightly balled up winter socks at our head.
I judged that we had pulled away from Miss Bodycote's about 50 minutes ago, and had therefore travelled at a speed of 40 miles per hour, approximately 33 miles. The calculation was a simple one. It had become surprisingly warm in the bus, and I was just beginning to think I might curl up on the seat for a cat nap, when the bus suddenly shifted down through several octaves of grating gears and turned off into a narrow, unpaved lane. The driver stopped, got out, and wrestled open a rusty metal gate, beside which was a ramshackle hut and a weathered sign that read, "Stop. Report to guard." We crept through. The driver closed the gate behind us, and again the bus's infernal gears ground into motion. Ahead, in the distance, lay the waters of Lake Ontario. I had seen it from the train, of course, but then it had been grey and sullen in the rain. Today the surface glittered and twinkled in the bright morning sunlight like a vast plain of blue-green jewels, and a fleet of white puffy clouds floated slowly and self-importantly along overhead, as if they were posing for a painting. A number of tall radio masts, painted in alternating red and white sections, rose into the air ahead, seeming to sprout from a cluster of low, white, weather-worn buildings, which nestled like chicks around an abandoned farmhouse of painted boards. As we approached them, the road narrowed and then ended. Abruptly, we had come to a stop.
"Everybody out!" Miss Moat commanded in a loud voice, and I looked round to see her unbuckling her restraints. With remarkable speed, she was free of her web and rolling herself toward the front of the bus. She came close to running me over. I counted bodies as the students disembarked. 10, 11, 12. I was the 13th.
"Bramp Dawson," Miss Moat snapped,
and from an underfloor luggage compartment, the driver dragged out a pair of wooden channels, which he manhandled into position at the door. Miss Moat manoeuvred her wheels onto them, and without a glance to either side, went barreling down so rapidly that she was propelled far beyond the bus and into the long grass. But no matter. In an instant, she had seized the rims of her wheels, swiveled as neat as a pin, and was back at the door, glaring defiantly up at the disembarking students, as if to say, "There, that's the only way to deal with the dragon polio." I was proud of her in a complicated sort of way. "Line up," she shouted, and there was something more than the sound of a drill sergeant in her voice. "Single file." We shuffled. "Right turn." Our shoes pivoted in the dust. "Quick, march." And away we went in our Panama hats, our pleated pinafore dresses, our blazers, our school ties, and our tights, swinging our arms as we trudged off toward a distant embankment of weeping willows, looking, no doubt, for all the world, like a dozen or so ugly ducklings on a forced march. I felt we ought to be whistling some bright but defiant military tune. Chapter 14. We were divided into two groups, the one into which I was placed, with Trout, Druce, Gremley, Barton, and an alarmingly red-faced girl I didn't know, was called, for obvious reasons, the Sixes, and the other, the Sevens. "Sixes in the shade," Miss Moat called out. "Sevens in the sun."
"Divide and conquer," Trout grumbled. "They always do that to keep us from overpowering them."
Although she and Gremley were part of my group, they wandered off and stood under a tall elm, while Druce and her hanger-on, Trout, stood off to the other side, leaving me with the girl, whose name I didn't know, alone between the two camps.
"Deluce," I said out of the corner of my mouth. "Flavia, I'm the new girl."
"I know," she whispered. "Well, I've been dying for a chance to talk to you."
She took off her hat and slowly fanned her face to cover our conversation. Who was she worried about? The lip-reading Druce or someone else?
"It's about Brazenose," she began.
"Which one?" I said quietly behind my hand, pretending to pick my nose.
"Mary Jane or
Clarissa? Brazenose Major, the one that disappeared."
Her face was becoming redder than ever.
"Are you all right?" I whispered. "Of course. I've been holding my breath to make myself flush. That's why Modi sent our group into the shade."
Here it was barely mid-morning, and I'd already added a new weapon to my arsenal.
"What's your name?"
I asked, even though it may have been forbidden. She gave me a strange smile, as if to reprimand me, then said,
"Scarlet, Amelia Scarlet."
"You are a girl after my own heart, Amelia Scarlet," I thought. "Without even suspecting it, the whole world is putty in your hands."
"Water," Miss Moat called out loudly, clapping her hands, and we all turned our attention toward her. "Water is life. Remember that, girls, and remember it well. You can live without food and sunlight for a remarkably long while, but you cannot live without water. You must know at all times and in all places how to acquire water. You will be taught, therefore, how to locate it, how to collect it, and how to purify it. Now then." She glared at us, one at a time, as if daring us to contradict her, her eyes like little black searchlights. "Let us say that we require water here and now. Let us say that one of us has sustained an injury, and that boiling water is required at once for emergency surgery. Where shall we find it?"
Gremley's hand shot up.
"In the radiator of the bus,"
she shouted, grinning at us, pleased as punch to